This episode of the All Things Risk podcast is a look back at some of our favorite clips from our favorite episodes of 2018. Welcome and welcome back to the All Things Risk podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I am your host. This is my show, and this is our now third annual Best of the Year episode. And I want to keep this intro short because this is always a rather long episode, but three things first. Number one, it's always incredibly difficult to come up with the best of any episode. My podcast episodes are a bit like children, my children. It's hard to have favorites. In addition, there isn't any scientific method I've used to come up with this set. I've left tons of great stuff out. I've had to. And in the whole process of putting this together, I was reminded of that scene from the film Dead Poets Society in which Robin Williams' character asks his pupils to rip out the page of their poetry book on how to rate poetry. So there's lots of great stuff that isn't here. And if you've listened to my podcast throughout the year and think that I've missed something, just let me know. Second, if you're new to the show, this is probably a great way to get familiar with it. So if something piques your interest, then check out the full episode. And third, and most importantly, I want to give you all a massive thank you for being with us, either from the start 3 years ago, or even if this is just your first episode. I'm very grateful that you are with us and that you have been with us. So let's get into it. And I tried to set this up and get this going by going big picture first and then narrowing things down in terms of topic area. And when I say big picture, I mean risks and uncertainties associated with geopolitics, the economy, society, technology, science, the environment, and so on. And in order for us to have a proper conversation about those things, we need to move away from the toxicity that pervades our society in these spaces. We are losing the ability to have meaningful conversations about this sort of stuff. And we need to focus on truth and facts. So with that, let's start with a clip from our conversation with Gleb Sapersky on how to seek truth.
Right. So if the point is to get to the truth, it's not helpful. Mm-hmm. And there are much more effective strategies that you could do from either perspective, you know. And that's called collaborative truth seeking. Mm. So collaborative truth seeking is an approach to dealing with disagreements. I mean, what is an argument? You're trying to, essentially a method of resolving a disagreement about the nature of reality. Mm. That's the point of an argument, you know. Otherwise, you know, it's just intellectual stimulation. Mm. So if what you're trying to do is trying to figure out what is the truth, you know, is it going to be better to raise taxes or lower taxes? Is it going to be better to have more government protections on, against pollution, or less government protections against pollution? You know, what's going to be better? Should we increase the salaries of high school teachers or decrease them? Something like that. Any of those things are meant to figure out the truth of the matter. Mm-hmm. So what is going to be best from the perspective, let's say from a social perspective, great social. So if what you're trying to do is figure out the truth, you're much better off collaborating with a person who has a different perspective. So collaborative truth seeking is an alternative approach, which is meant not to defend your perspective, but it's meant to figure out the nature of reality on the matter at hand. Mm-hmm. So what it starts with is establishing trust. You want to figure out how to establish trust with your opponent. So, and then that includes backing away from the term opponent, which I just used as an example, and going to collaborator. So you establish trust with your collaborator. You help her trust you, and you trust her because you will be both orienting toward the truth and the facts above your ideological perspective about what you're talking about. So, and that involves going to the person's emotions, that goes going to the autopilot system. So you don't want to only go toward reason and logic. You want to show that you are listening to them, so actively listen, so echo their perspective. And that shows their autopilot system, their emotions, that you are hearing what they're saying. you know, you might be totally understanding what they're saying. You might be totally grasping exactly what they're saying. But if they don't know it, they will be anxious. They will be confused and uncertain. And that will often derail effective conversations.
Sergey Popovich knows a thing or two about democracy and toppling dictators. And speaking about democracy, the theme of its retreat have come up time and again at various points this year. So here is Sergey giving his view about that.
When you take a look at the last decade in particular, unfortunately, this is the decade of democracy decay. And when you take a look, whether you're looking at the Economist analysis or Freedom House analysis, you can see that authoritarianism is on the growth and freedoms of the people are on the defense in many of these countries. This is particularly worrying trend when it is happening in countries that were partly democratic, like Turkey, or wholly democratic, like some other countries you have mentioned. And we are witnessing the phenomenon, which is that the bad guys are learning, how to meddle with the elections and use the very democratic tools to root up democracy as such. And whether you can talk about the propaganda effort mostly coming from Russia to show that democracy is a stupid thing and it's no better than the autocracy, which is meaning hitting the very foundations, or you are looking at a slowly squeezing thing called illiberal democracy, which is present now in Hungary or in Poland, where the populists gain power through democracy and then immediately start killing the foundations of democracy by stuffing judges with their party comrades and turning the national TV or the public service like BBC into their party megaphones. We are witnessing the same process. What is different now is that the groups need to find a way to defend democratic pillars. And I think defending the democratic pillars, things like free media, judiciary, Congress, Senate in US, elections in UK, is the best way to proceed. So you understand that, first of all, people need to wake up. And this is what many people in the West are figuring out slowly but steadily, that the fact that you had democracy for so many years doesn't mean that you can take it for granted. Because if your democratic institutions are not defended by the people, then the politicians will come and screw it up. This is the nature of the political system. Democracy is not only institutions. If people abandon keeping their electables accountable, then, you know, they can overturn any kind of institution into a tool for autocracy. And that can have been happening in the past in many cases. You can look at the countries where this process is really dramatic, places like Russia, which had far more democratic 10 years ago, Turkey, which was used to be the best case of Islam and democracy, or Philippines. Which were the democracy for decades. And you can see how the bad guys are coming there and actually using elections to get to power and then are killing one by one the democratic pillars or institutions. So the difference is that in an established autocracy, you're challenging the government and challenging the pillars. In a shrinking democracy, you need to defend your pillars. And that also means changing the narrative. We need a new narrative to explain to the people, specifically in Western Europe, that the fact that they had democracy for too long and ignored autocracies on too many different places have only mean that the autocracy is now on can be on their doorstep. And we need to wake up and defend democratic pillars.
How worried are you about what seems to be a rising trend amongst younger people, you know, millennials, who in the West, we've got surveys that are showing that they're losing their interest in democracy, which seems like, you know, the complete reverse of the situation that you had growing up and being a student in Serbia.
It's an interesting thing. I think, I mean, my opinion is that we are criticizing these millennials too much because only because we are getting to become old farts. And it is more or less the same reason why our parents were thinking that listening to punk rock and new wave music will destroy my brain cells. But it didn't. So I think that we need to figure out that, I mean, on one hand, it's a question of how the millennials understand democracy. On second hand, they're very challenging to any kind of power. And that can tell you anybody who ever employed a millennial. And I have my office full of interns, mainly Western organized students. Mm-hmm. And the way they behave, the way they go straight for the topic, the way that find a way to abandon structures, it's really impressive. I mean, for somebody my age, I'm 45, it's really impressive. So on one hand, they may be less interest in democracy as it is, if the surveys show that. And on another hand, they have more guts to challenge power itself, which is actually very good prerequisite for people power movement. So I think we need to find a way to basically rebuild the narrative of democracy and values of democracy in the Western world. And I don't think it's a particularly generational issue. I think it's more of a societal task, which should be, of course, embedded in the education.
So you sound very optimistic then. What are some of the ways that you're witnessing millennials challenge power structures in a positive way?
Well, I mean, I'm teaching in this moment in the United States, where actually the bunch of high school students from a school where a massive shooting happened in Florida is shaking the narrative around gun control far more effectively than all the politicians, NGOs, and liberal groups the last 15 years. Yes. The reason for this is A, they are vigilant. B, they are mobilizing in schools. C, they are mobilizing across the political spectrum, understanding that their parents are first parents and then Republicans or then Democrats, which is really interesting. And most important, by tackling the right pillars of the support, what is really happening is that around the gun control issue in U.S., you have an omnipowerful organization called National Rifle Association. So instead of going and yelling on the street, these millennials are understanding that they need to target National Rifle Association. So what they do, they are encouraging firms and companies to dispatch and disconnect from National Rifle Association. Up to now, Delta did it. United did it. Hertz and Enterprise Rent-A-Car did it. So they are looking at how to financially weaken the pillar, which is in the theory absolutely the best way to deal with the companies and business society. So even without any kind of training, these guys are very successful. Recently, their pressure resulted in very places that are vendoring machine guns, places like Exporting Goods or Walmart, to really impose the ban of the legal age from 18 to 21, ban certain type of weapons, or basically impose more control on how this weapons is sold. That means that in 3 weeks, this movement achieved on the ground less accessibility to assault weapons than the politicians from the liberal side have achieved throughout the 20 years.
Up next is a clip from my very recent conversation with Oliver Buller, who wrote the Times of London's business book of 2018, Moneyland. And here he talks about exactly what he means by Moneyland.
Well, Moneyland came to me as an idea in 2014 when I was exploring one of Viktor Yanukovych's residences. This isn't a residence he had as president of Ukraine. This is a residence he'd built for himself with money he'd stolen on land that he'd stolen. And it was kind of a pleasure garden in the middle of a forest, a gorgeous place, you know, with a yacht harbor and a shooting range, a duck lake, a huge sort of hunting lodge, massive outdoor barbecue area. It was really extraordinary. And I'd wandered around this and sort of checked out the heated massage table and the plunge pool and all the kind of amenities. And I said to Anton, who's a friend of mine, who's a revolutionary, I said, how could you have let this happen? How did you let him get away with this? And Anton, he sort of slightly exploded at me, and as far as he ever does, he's a fairly chilled guy. And he just said, listen, we didn't know this was here. We didn't know any of this. You got to understand how well this was hidden. This land, it was in England. You know, it's not in Ukraine at all. And what he meant was that the property that this hunting lodge was built on was owned by an offshore company in the UK. And then that UK company was owned by another UK company, and that was owned by a company in Liechtenstein, or a foundation in Liechtenstein. And so essentially, in legal terms, this place wasn't really in Ukraine at all. It was somewhere else. And the whole Ukrainian elite were doing this. It wasn't just the president or the ministers, the you know, the lawmen, the oligarchs, they were all keeping all of their property offshore in this way. But the thing about offshore is it's this term that we use a lot, but we don't really understand, because it doesn't. You think of offshore and you think of, I don't know, somewhere in the Caribbean with white beaches and palm trees and so on. You know, that's, or you think maybe Monaco, you know, something like that. You think, well, if it's not offshore, it's not here, then it's there. But it isn't there either. The property isn't anywhere. Offshore just means somewhere else. And so I wanted to find a way to understand this. And that's when I came up with the idea of Moneyland, because I said, well, this property, this hunting lodge, it's not in Ukraine and it's not in Britain. And it's not in Liechtenstein, it's in Moneyland. And once you start thinking about the world like that, if you look at the amount of property which is held elsewhere, offshore, which is just not where it's supposed to be, you know, it's somewhere between 8 and 10% of all the money in the world, which makes Moneyland the third richest country on earth after the United States and China. And, you know, and that is a profoundly troubling thought, the idea that there is this sort of, you know, huge store of wealth which is totally unaccountable, which is totally anonymous, which is out there, you know, and it's like a sort of malevolent poltergeist, you know, we can't see it, we can't touch it, we don't know where it is, but it can see us and it can touch us, so it can interfere in the rest of the world as freely as it likes to, but we can't interfere with it. And that makes it a real challenge to the nature of democracy. You know, the core function of a democratic government is to tax the wealth of its citizens for the common good of everyone. If you can't do that because money is anonymously held offshore, then you're not really a democracy anymore. And you know, and this is a real challenge to the liberal order, and a challenge that does not get anything like the recognition it needs to have.
Speaking about money and corruption, let's throw a little fraud into the mix, shall we? This next clip comes from my conversation with Dan Davies talking about the role of trust in fraud.
Yeah, absolutely. Or actually, the one thing that's kind of was suggested to me after the book was published was by Taleb, who was saying that, you know, look at the business networks of Lebanese traders. The business networks of Lebanese traders probably show how far you can push and the absolute limits of how far you can push a system that is purely based on personal trust. Because Lebanese importers and exporters the world over do business based on family ties and personal connections, you know, in many cases going back further into history than you can sort of possibly imagine. And it works for them, but it's worth noting that the global networks of the Lebanese traders all over Africa and the Americas is the only example of one of those family-based networks that there are. It's very difficult to run an economy on that basis. And you can't grow that way. You can't really kind of set out and pioneer a new country like the United States of America or Canada on that basis. And so in Canada, it's the exact opposite of what you had in the Nigerian system. It's very democratic. Anyone who likes in Canada, if they've got a decent education and one good suit, they can probably end up with a fraudulent mining stock promotion and steal a few million dollars. You know, eventually they might end up getting caught by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. But the reason it works is that most people don't do it. And part of the state of affairs that makes it possible to get away with so many scams in Canada, and particularly its regional stock exchanges, some of which are just appalling, is that it's possible to start up a legitimate business in Canada. And actually, starting up and running a legitimate business for most people is a more obvious thing to do than starting up a fraud. So you have places like Greece, where it's quite difficult, unless you're in the government, to commit a crime of dishonesty because no one will do business with you. But it's also incredibly difficult to start up a new company because no one will do business with you.
Mm-hmm. And if you're that fraudulent Canadian mining company owner, you can get away with it. You can restart. However, if you're that Lebanese trader, the local villager, or the Greek merchant, if you commit a fraud and you're found guilty of it, everything goes away.
You absolutely. You're out of all your business networks. You're out of your threat social networks, you're probably even out of your family.
From fraud to football. In our next clip, Ken Benzinger, author of Red Card, FIFA and the Fall of the Most Powerful Men in Sports, talks about the dark story behind Russia's World Cup.
We're very unlikely to know whatever happened with Russia's bid to get the World Cup. One wild anecdote out of all this is that after Russia and Qatar awarded the World Cups, the two countries that on paper are least prepared to host World Cups, FIFA orders, under a lot of public outrage and pressure, orders its own audit type investigation of the two of all the bids for the World Cups in those rounds. They hire a former American federal prosecutor by the name of Michael Garcia, who was then at a law firm in the States, to run an investigation. He travels all around the world doing this investigation, and when it finally comes out, Russia is absolved of any wrongdoing. But if you read what they did with Russia, you have serious questions, because it turns out that when investigators went to Russia to look at their books, to look at their records and understand what they did, the Russian bid team informed them that the computers they had used to run the bid had been leased computers, and that immediately after the bidding was completed, they returned the leased computers to the group that leased them to them. Well, that was a soccer foundation that was closely linked to one of Putin's best friends, the Russian oligarch Roman Abramovich. And the first thing that soccer foundation did was to destroy all the computers and all the information they contained. So FIFA decided to give Russia a clean bill of health based on zero evidence, because there's no evidence. There's no information whatsoever about what would happen. Who knows what happened? It's all destroyed, right? I guess it's possible that that Department of Justice might have some information they've never put in public about what Russia did. But as far as FIFA goes, we're never going to hear anything, I don't think. And so now Russia has its World Cup. Vladimir Putin has the World Cup he wanted. And I think he's making it very much his party, right? Right. He's at the opening ceremony, of course. But a week later, he's inviting Sepp Blatter to come be his guest of honor at the World Cup too, which is a kind of a aggressive, I think, political statement, because Sepp Blatter, after the U.S. case broke open, although he was never indicted by the U.S., was pressured to resign, which he did, and then he was put under criminal investigation in Switzerland, and then FIFA itself banned him, the ethics committee banned him from the sport, and he's currently banned for six years from the sport, which means effectively he shouldn't be going to any FIFA events. But Putin obviously does things his own way and doesn't really care what other people say, and he decided to invite Blatter anyway. He said, I don't care what FIFA says, you're my guest of honor. Blatter, who is a guy who's got his entire self-image wrapped up in running the sport or being involved in the sport, was all too happy to accept the invite, and he's been running around Russia for the last week or so, and he attended a couple of matches, and it's all very much sort of Putin thumbing his nose both at FIFA and the West. I think it's, you could say it's not a particularly gracious way to proceed. FIFA awarded the World Cup to Russia, which they so wanted, and in response, Putin is thumbing his nose at FIFA. There's the irony in the fact that Infantino, who is the new president of FIFA, would never have the job if not for the fact that Russia was probably acting, was definitely acting in a suspicious way back in 2010, if you follow the history, right? Russia was doing something shady, potentially to win the World Cup. This alerts Christopher Steele, which sparks his massive criminal investigation, which, among other things, leads to the downfall of Sepp Blatter. And that allows Infantino, who never was going to be president of FIFA, to become president of FIFA, because so many other people fell. It opened a otherwise impossible path to his presidency. So you have this guy who is in that position because essentially of Putin's questionable acts years earlier, sitting beside Putin at the opening of the World Cup, and then a week later Putin is hanging out with his predecessor. It's the kind of stuff that guys with pushpins, corkboards, and red string love to theorize about in their basement, but it's actually happening, right? And I mean, today's news, the most recent news I found fascinating, was that now Putin and Donald Trump are going to have a summit, and that summit is going to take place in Helsinki on July 16th, which is the day after the World Cup final. The World Cup final is July 15th. The following day, these two guys are going to meet. And I can only take that as another PR victory for Putin.
Absolutely.
Right? The World Cup.
Yeah,
yeah, right? The World Cup is his big party. And then the next day, he gets to show the whole rest of the world that he can get the U.S. to meet with him and give him an opportunity to loudly say that Russia's wonderful and never done anything wrong.
Next up, we have a clip from my chat with science writer David Quammen about horizontal gene transfer evolution and his book, The Tangled Tree.
Right. And much of my work, as you say, both in the magazine form and the books that I've written, has involved this sort of field biology and outdoor adventure and following scientists through jungles or climbing up onto rooftops in Bangladesh in the middle of the night to trap bats for the scientist who desperately hopes that these bats contain a lethal virus. So there has been risk and narrative possibilities and adventure in these other books. But then after I did the disease work in 2013, spring of 2013, I just happened in my various reading to come across mention of this phenomenon, horizontal gene transfer. And my first reaction was, wait, what? What? Genes moving sideways across species boundaries, across boundaries between kinds of creatures that are not even closely related from one kingdom of life into another. And my first reaction was, well, that's impossible. And I've written three or four books about evolution by that point, and I thought that I knew the reasons why it was impossible. But it turns out, as I read more deeply, I found out that it is possible, and there is good documentation, good evidence for it having occurred over the long stretches of time, genes moving sideways from one lineage into another, tangling the tree of life so that the history of life on Earth hasn't been only just a matter of lineages diverging from one another and yielding biological diversity like the leaves on the canopy of the tree. But it has also involved convergence of lineages in the form of several processes that I describe in the book, including this process, horizontal gene transfer. And it startled me when I read about this in 2013. But as I dug into it further, I discovered, well, there's a whole world of work here, and it's fascinating. It's got some intriguing characters and some amazing revelations, and so it became a book project for me.
Could you give go for it. Sorry.
Despite the fact that it didn't allow me the advantage of walking through any jungles with scientists, except for these jungles of genomic data, as I said.
It's the whole concept sounds fascinating. I'm not a scientist, but as you describe, the kind of classic view of evolution is this branches off of a tree, which actually you also describe that it was, you know, revolutionary at the time. You know, when Darwin came home, he wasn't exactly, didn't exactly publish this stuff right away. But could you perhaps give us some examples of horizontal gene transfer that just to bring this to life a little bit? What are some of the examples describe? Yeah.
We've already mentioned one category of this phenomenon, and that is the passage of genes from one kind of bacterium into another, sideways. These packets of genes, single genes or packets of genes, that can move sideways from Staphylococcus into Streptococcus, Streptococcus into E. coli, spreading this resistance to antibiotics. But it also occurs in more complex forms of life. It can occur. It's known to have occurred in insects. It's known to have occurred in simple animals. It's known even to have occurred in invertebrate animals and even in humans. And so I'll bounce right to the most dramatic instance that I described toward the end of my book, which is the fact, as now known from genomic data, the human genome having been sequenced, we now know that roughly 8% of the human genome, yours and mine and everybody else's, is viral DNA that has been captured through sideways transmission over a long period of time, over the course of mammal evolution, 80 or 100 million years, but that 8% of our genome is viral DNA that has come in not by direct lineal descent from our remote animal ancestors, but by infection. They call it infective heredity. Mm-hmm. Infection by retroviruses that have been captured in our genome. Now, just before I get into specifics, I'll just say very briefly, you know, retrovirus, people have heard that term because HIV causing AIDS is a retrovirus. Retro suggesting backwards, and it's backwards because its genome is an RNA genome, a single strand of genetic information rather than a double strand like the double helix DNA molecule. DNA in most cases makes RNA, which is an information molecule, and then that is used to construct bodies, proteins, physical anatomy. Retroviruses go backwards because they can turn their RNA into DNA and then patch it into the genome of a cell of some creature that they infect. Now, when HIV does that, it patches itself into the genomes of immune cells. It infects immune cells and replicates by using the immune cells to make copies of itself. But if a retrovirus patches itself not into the immune cells of a human, but into the reproductive cells, eggs or sperm, ovaries or testes, then it can become heritable. It can be passed down to offspring, that retroviral DNA. And that is what has happened, yielding eventually this 8% of our genomes that have come in by infection.
And relatively, I'm going to kind of butcher this question because I'm not a biologist or a scientist, but if we think about the kind of classical, and what you're saying is not that, you know, this sort of tree of life format of evolution is you're saying that it still exists for the vast majority of you know, the mutations and adaptations and so forth. But if we were to think about infective hereditary changes to our genome, how much more quickly would that type of evolutionary change happen versus the more classical forms of evolutionary change? I don't know if this makes, you know,
Ben, that's not a butchered question. Okay. That's a good, totally coherent question.
Okay.
For which there is an answer. This form is much quicker. Mm-hmm. The old view of evolution, and Charles Darwin even quoted this old Latin adage, natura non facit saltum. Mm-hmm. Nature does not make leaps. So the classic Darwinian view and neo-Darwinian understanding from the 20th century is that variation in populations of creatures appears by incremental mutation, tiny mistakes as the genetic material copies itself. Darwin didn't know about genes, so he wouldn't have said genes, but tiny differences arise, and then natural selection works upon those variations in populations, and it serves as a sort of a strainer, and only the fittest survive to leave offspring, and lineages change because of that process. Incremental mutation creating variation, natural selection yielding linear change and adaptation. What's new, and that's all still true, these discoveries don't overturn that, they just add to that. And the main thing they add is a new quantum form of variation coming in by horizontal gene transfer. So it's not just these tiny, tiny steps, it's these lumps of change, these lumps of innovation that can come into a lineage and offer suddenly a major new possibility upon which natural selection then works.
From the natural world to the artificial world, we now go into my conversation with Keith First and Daniel Wagner on their book, AI Supremacy. the individual, right? So in your chapter on manufacturing, you said, well, there will be jobs that will be created, and those jobs will actually revolve around the types of things that make us more human. So things that involve intuition, creativity, curiosity, those types of things. And I thought, well, that sounds great. That's really good. We'll have more interesting jobs. But later on in the book, you talk about how Amazon, for example, has a way of nudging and tracking people's productivity, right? And quite possibly a way of influencing its employees' neural pathways and what we're thinking potentially, and so that creates an interesting dichotomy, because on the one hand, you know, we might be using more of the things in our jobs that make us human, but on the other hand, more of those things might be influenced by those with a monopoly, as you say, Keith, and those that have an agenda. So I thought that was very interesting, and I just wanted to perhaps get some of your thoughts around all of that.
Yeah, well, yeah, that is a very, I mean, it's just a glimpse, you know. I think a lot of this book is that we're catching glimpses of what's to come. And to me, that, I mean, it's such a subtle thing. And, you know, what's the problem? You have somebody in a factory and they wear a wristband, and you say, okay, you know, let's, you know, pack this thing more efficiently. And then you sort of, you know, we're just going to nudge you the right way. But then, when you start to look at the other developments that are happening, specifically in the healthcare space, there's a lot going on with mapping brain activity. They can even, like, you know, scan your brain and reconstruct an image fairly accurately. You know, looking at what type of neural activity, what it's representing. You know, so if they can nudge you the right way with a wristband, you know, what's to say that in the future, you know, the company's not going to read your mind and try to influence it. I mean, these things could be very far out, but, you know, if we don't begin to address them now and set boundaries of, you know, as a society, as a culture, what are we willing to give up? What's right? What's wrong? You know, what it means to be human. Then we could lose sight of this, and then, you know, this could all become the new normal. But is that a new normal that we want to live in? You know,
there's a lot of sub themes and sub contexts that are going on, as you've both pointed out. On one hand, our premise is that as AI develops further, it's going to encourage the best and the brightest to shine. And even those perhaps who weren't considered or didn't consider themselves to be the best and the brightest, it may encourage them to be more than they previously were or might be in the future as a result, because the nature of the competitive landscape is changing in the process. But vis-a-vis Amazon and nudging, I think in general, it's incumbent upon us to determine what the limitations are going to be for AI, because some people envision that there will at some point in time, and presumably not too far in the future, be this super intelligence wherein the robots are going to be smarter than we are, and they're not going to need to be supervised, and they're going to be totally autonomous, and we'll have this iRobot kind of future. A lot of this stuff that we consider to be the realm of science fiction is quickly becoming reality. And some experts believe that it won't be too long, maybe even just a couple of decades, before we're facing that kind of a reality.
We now talk travel survival. Here's a clip from my conversation with Lloyd Figgins.
If that bus is traveling at 50 kilometers an hour, and then it hits something, everything inside it is still traveling at 50 kilometers an hour, including that person who is not secured in, that weighs 75 kilos. Well, that is 75 kilos traveling at 50 kilometers an hour. Whatever that hits, it's going to do a huge amount of damage. So it is actually, when you explain that to people as to why they need to put their seatbelt on, they usually buy into that. And I've also found that, you know, there's a huge amount of peer pressure that comes in.
And even if they don't fly into somebody else, if they do get hurt, then they've trip's got to stop. They've got to get treatment.
Exactly.
It's expensive. It holds everybody else up.
Incident management is a lot more expensive and time consuming and troublesome than
simple prevention.
Prevention. Mm. And I think the more people that understand that, then the safer the world actually becomes. But we've got to be able to explain why. It's got to be, there's got to be something in it for people. People only do something if there's something in it for them. So that's how I like when I provide training, is to explain those things and actually make risk everybody's responsibility. It's not the responsibility of the leader of an expedition or a work trip or anything else. It's actually everybody's responsibility. And by doing that, we can make things a lot safer and continue to push boundaries. And this is the key point. I am a great believer that we can't let health and safety take over. I believe that we've got to continue to push boundaries. In 1969, we put two blokes on the moon. That was not without risk. It was about pushing those boundaries. But behind Aldrin and Armstrong were a team of 400,000 making sure that everything stayed on track, and they all had a responsibility. Now, take that into a micro level. We can do that if we can do it to put two blokes on the moon, we can do it for anything.
In spite of the best planning for an adventure, things can still go wrong, and they did for Oscar Scafidi and Alfie Weston in their journey to kayak the Kwanzaa River in Angola. At one point, they got arrested. Here's that story.
Yeah, so I think in the planning stage, of all the reasons that the journey would have ended prematurely, we would never have thought that getting arrested would be on the list. What happened was I'm not saying this to blame Alfie. Alfie was in charge of sorting out our permits to do this journey before we went. Because Angola is a very, very bureaucratic country. I think they've inherited a fair amount of the bureaucracy from Portuguese. Mm-hmm. And we both had visas to be in the country. So technically speaking, we didn't need anyone's permission to go anywhere in the country. We should be allowed to swim in the river, kayak in it, go wherever. As long as you had a visa, that's fine. In reality, though, that's not the way things work. And we knew that we're going to meet overly officious security forces and police who were going to say, wait a minute, where's your permit to do this? So Alfie spent months getting us reams of paperwork from the Ministry of the Environment, from the Ministry of Tourism, from the Ministry of Interior, saying, here's what we're doing, and is this okay? And we got like an 11-page document from one of the ministries saying, yeah, this is all fine. And even with all that paperwork, it all went wrong. So we were kayaking next to Kapanda Dam, which is the massive hydroelectric installation that powers a lot of Angola cities. And we actually went past it. So obviously not safe to go kayaking near a dam. So we went past it and camped in a village that was about 10 kilometers from the dam. Mm-hmm. And when we stopped at the village and we said, is it okay to camp here? They said, yeah, sure. And we said, is there a police post where we can register? And they said, yes, let's get them on the phone. They're up in the town. So we tried to phone them, but there's no mobile phone signal. And they said, look, don't worry, it's late. You guys camp. Tomorrow morning, we'll walk you up the hill and you can register with the police. So we said, yeah, no problem. So we cooked up a load of fish, hung out with the people in the village, and then went to bed. And then next thing we know, around midnight, you hear a bunch of people stomping into the village, asking where we are, tents unzipped, AK barrels in the tent, people grabbing in, pulled us out, handcuffed us, said, we're under arrest. Wow. not a very pleasant way to be woken up. It went slightly better for me than for Alfie because I'd gone through my usual evening routine of unbandaging my feet. So my feet were looking absolutely disgusting, like, pus and blood and whatever. So I knew what was happening as well. I could hear, and I knew that, okay, this is the police being stupid, but it should be fine if we cooperate. So, the barrel comes in the tent, then a hand comes in the tent with handcuffs, and I just kind of shoved my feet out the tent in their faces. And said, look, I'm not going to run anywhere. You can see I'm not going to run anywhere. So please give me some space. I'll put some clothes on and I'll come out. And they were like, oh, okay, yeah. Well, kind of disgusted by my feet. Whereas Alfie, I think, had been, in a deeper sleep or perhaps, and he misunderstood the situation. He thought we're getting robbed, basically. Mm. So he thought that the guys weren't police at all. They're just guys with guns, which could have happened. So he was resisting. I think he grabbed one of the barrels and pushed it out of the tent. And so they were a little bit more rough with him. They actually dragged him out and kind of hit him and put their knees in the back of his neck and things to handcuff him. So he got it a little bit rougher than I did. But yeah, both got handcuffs. And I think what happened was it was just, you know, those were the police who were in charge of guarding the hydroelectric dam. They got overexcited. I think I don't know if they generally thought we were spying or if they just felt a little affronted that we hadn't asked them for permission to camp there before camping there. Mm-hmm. But I mean, either way, it didn't matter. You know, we were in their turf. We hadn't played it by their rules, and they decided that we were under arrest. So they took us up to the police station and chucked us in the cells for the night, basically. And you know, no matter how much paperwork we kept waving at them and saying, you know, this is what we're doing, we have permission, they just weren't willing to listen. And that was the beginning of a four-day saga that almost saw us deported.
Let's move on to hearing about negotiations. This is from episode 71 that was with Gary Nesner, who was the FBI's chief hostage negotiator, and without a doubt, one of the most interesting people in the world.
We call it the behavioral change stairway, mm-hmm. and it's something I developed in the FBI many years ago.
Right.
And the top of the stair is basically cooperation. Mm-hmm. So in order to climb up to that final ultimate goal of a step, you have to have influence. You know, before I can suggest alternatives to whatever you're doing, I have to be able to have influence. Mm-hmm. You do that, the next lower step down is rapport, you know, teaching this backwards. You know, in some rapport, you get empathy. It leads to rapport, understanding. And empathy, you get through active listening skills. So the reason we charted it out in that progressing stairway is to teach negotiators that it's a process. You don't show up in a challenging, difficult, life-threatening situation and say, you know, Mr. Smith, we only talked for 2 minutes, but I already know what you need to do because you're acting like a complete ass. And so you're going to surrender in about 30 minutes. But so let's just cut this crap out and just get there. Well, no, that's not going to happen. you have to go through this process of demonstrating I'm listening, I'm understanding, I'm demonstrating I'm understanding. Because of that, I'm showing you I'm an empathic person. We now have some rapport. Maybe we've talked about something that, you know, we have in common. And now I can begin to be of influence or suggest, you know, you might think about this or that. You know, there's doesn't have to end the way that maybe you thought it would. I think there's some other options here that you might want to think about. But that's basically the process in a nutshell. It's not rocket science. A lot of people believe negotiations is about manipulation and trickery and psychological gamesmanship. And perhaps some people practice it that way, but I don't. I believe it's plain old simple relationship building. And I've just seen it work too many times for me to believe any other approach is appropriate. Mm-hmm. You know, people, you're not going to win every situation in the dangerous hostage barricade situation. There will be people that will kill themselves or kill somebody else. But in the high 90 percentile, if you approach it in this thoughtful way, you de-escalate, you lower the emotions, you demonstrate a willingness to listen and to speak, you're more likely, far more likely to get the outcome that you want. It's a proven method. It works.
Yeah. Without a doubt, what you speak. It's not something that is easy for a lot of people. Particularly, and I'm thinking about very driven people who see, you know, outcome, you know, point A to point B, and that's, you know, yep. They just want to get in between, you know, the two points as quickly as possible. And that's, you see that a lot with CEOs, but also people who are just very, you know,
well,
driven.
It's law enforcement, it's the military, mm-hmm. but it's like, you know, American executives fly over to Tokyo to meet with the Japanese, and they'll sit down at the table and say, okay, you know, we got to make this deal on the widgets that you're providing for us and how much they cost per unit. But the Japanese guy will say, well, was your father also in this manufacturing business? No. My dad was a, you know, a cattle rancher. And so, well, you didn't want to be a cattle rancher like your dad. You know, so they changed the whole conversation. They want the relationship first.
Sure.
We want to get right down to business. And it's, it's Western, it's particularly American, but, you know, Canadian as well and British, but Americans are particularly driven at it. And it takes a bit of practice to change gears and slow things down a bit. It pays dividends, but it takes practice. You know, we're just, you know, you might remember the old television show Dragnet, you know, where Detective Joe Friday's just the facts, ma'am, just the facts. Yep, no. He's a terrible, terrible investigator. Yeah, yeah. You know, he had a successful TV show and he was a nice man, but it was a terrible approach. Sure. You know, he did nothing to encourage people to tell him what you normally would in a real situation. So, you know, the key to it is in life, and particularly in law enforcement and in business, is getting people to cooperate and getting people to help you accomplish your goal, whether it's making a sale, getting a confession, securing their testimony, you know, getting them to work harder at supplying the things that you need for your raw materials, whatever it might be. So you have to just invest the time in doing that. And you're not going to win 100% of the time, but most of the time you
sure.
are.
Sure. Yeah, I was thinking about that other TV show, Columbo, and it was always, what are you saying?
Oh,
just one more thing, or well, make by
sure
the way.
He'd say, like, yeah. Let me make sure I understand. Yeah. What you're saying is this, is that right?
Yeah.
So he was demonstrating he was listening.
Yes.
And he was quite effective. His approach was excellent, as in contrast to the other. But yeah, I mean, I just, to me, this is fascinating stuff, and I try to look for manifestations of it in everyday life, you know, and I'm far from perfect. You know, there's times where I say to myself later on, boy, you sure didn't do that right, you know. And sometimes we're all in a rush, you know, and I should spend the time talking to this guy in the parking lot, but I got to get home, I'm in a rush, you know, whatever. You know, we're all guilty of that. But when you stop and think about it, you know, invest the time and you can be pleasantly surprised by what you learn.
We now hear about decision making, a concept called resulting, and why poker is a great metaphor for life, with former world poker champion and author of Thinking in Bets, Annie Duke.
So I opened the book up with this concept called resulting. And that it's basically what we just talked about. It's, you know, sort of working backwards from the result to say something about the quality of the decision, right? So so the example I give is actually from American football, where the Seattle Seahawks are playing the New England Patriots in the Super Bowl, and they're down by 4, and the coach of the Seahawks, a guy named Pete Carroll, calls for a pass play. And they're down by 4. It's the last play of the game, and there's only 26 seconds left in the game. So this is all or nothing here. He calls for a pass play. The ball is intercepted in the end zone, so that means the game is over. The New England Patriots win, and everybody screamed that Pete Carroll made a terrible decision. So what happened there was, we know it was a terrible outcome. The play didn't work. It ended the game with the Patriots winning. That's obviously the worst outcome for the Seattle Seahawks. So we know it was a really bad outcome. But what ended up happening was that people worked backwards from that bad outcome to declare that the decision itself was bad. And this is a little bit kind of what Bloomberg did in its headline, right? So UBS went through some sort of process in terms of determining what the probability of Germany winning was. They said that Germany was the favorite. When Germany lost, Bloomberg then took the fact that they lost to work backwards to say that their prediction that Germany was the favorite was bad.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But we know that 76% of the time that's going to occur. So it's actually not, doesn't tell you anything about whether Germany was the favorite. It just tells you that Germany lost that one time. And this is true for the Seahawks too. The probability of an interception in that particular spot, on the most conservative measure that you could come up with, is only about 2%. So it's only going to end in this disastrous result 2% of the time. 90%, 98% of the time, it's going to end up in some other way. So just on that basis alone, it's like, it seems a little weird to say that the decision was bad and that it wasn't just bad luck.
I was just thinking, for my listeners who may not follow NFL or American football, when I was listening to what you were talking about in your book, I thought, yeah, that decision makes total sense, because if, as you say, only a 2% chance, so 98% of the time they will, you know, they'll score, or it will be, say, an incomplete pass. And the way that the clock works in that game, it meant that if that was the case, it was, say, an incomplete pass, then they would get two more attempts to mm-hmm. win the game. So what the coach was doing was giving them three attempts to win the game from where they were, as opposed to if they didn't call that play, they would probably only get two attempts.
Correct. And you're paying kind of a 2% chance of this bad thing
That's
happening
right.
in
That's
order
right.
to get three chances instead of two. Exactly. So here's the general problem that we have as decision makers. When we're making a decision prospectively, we're making a decision about a set of possible futures that can occur. But we know that only one possible future can happen, right? So there's all these possible futures that can occur. And then as the future unfolds, only one of those paths actually happens. So what we're trying to do as decision makers is try to figure out, how do I make a decision that's going to get me across the set of possible futures, kind of the highest probability of a good result? Now, what we know is that in that set, there are some bad things, right? There are some bad futures that are going to occur. We can't protect ourselves against, you know, the interception, right? I can make really, really good decisions, say, in driving. I can drive on the right side of the road. I can make sure my car is in good repair. I can follow all the rules of the road. I can only go through green lights. And so that's obviously improving the set of possible futures for me. But among those futures is somebody, you know, coming through the intersection the other way and hitting me. And I can't do anything about that. And if I get hit, it doesn't mean that my decisions were poor.
Sure.
But that's what we do. That's how we act. Once a future occurs, we act as if that was the only possible future. And then we use that to work backwards to whether the decision was good. And the reason that we do that is because most decisions don't have as much consensus around them as whether we follow traffic laws. Most decisions are actually quite hidden from view. Mm-hmm. So Pete Carroll's decision there for the Seahawks, it's really hidden from view, sort of what the mathematics of that decision are. And, you know, in any game, that's true, right? Whether you're watching soccer or you're watching tennis, we can't see through to the player's decision process. So we're sort of guessing at it.
Hmm.
So, you know, for example, like, you know, when somebody has a free kick in soccer, you know, whether the goalie goes right, mm-hmm. stays in the center, goes left. Well, you know, when the goalie dives left and the player actually hits it to the right side of the goal, it's very hard not to say that the goalie made a bad decision there.
Right.
Except we don't know that the goalie made a bad decision because he's making a guess and we don't know what he sees. And, you know, it could be a perfectly good decision that had a bad result because at the last minute or whatever it might be, but we connect those together very tightly. So this is why poker is such a better model for decision making than something like chess.
Mm-hmm.
And it really has to do with this resulting problem, this working backwards problem. So if we think about chess, if I play a game of chess against you, and the only thing that somebody knows is that I lost the game to Ben, that's all they know. What do they know about my decision making relative to yours?
Well, it's fairly absolute, or it is relative. I mean, you've made a mistake somewhere along the lines, I suppose.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. So in chess, I can work backwards from the outcome. If you tell me what the outcome was, I lost to Ben, we can say something about what my decision making was relative to yours. We know it was worse. So, and that's because chess has very little uncertainty. There's very little luck involved in the game. I mean, certainly not in the sense that someone rolls, you know, a dice and the dice comes up 11 and now my bishop gets pulled off the board or something,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's really no hidden information because I can see the whole position. So any move is, I can calculate it out.
Right. It'd be totally different if you blocked off a quarter of the board, for example.
Correct.
Yeah.
Exactly. That would be very different.
Yeah.
Right. But now let's think about poker. Let's say that we play a hand of poker and I lose the hand to you. What do we know about my decision making relative to yours?
you could have made a good decision or it could have been luck.
Right. So we don't know. We have no idea. So I could have the very best hand. I could play the hand perfectly and I could still lose.
Hmm.
And here's the interesting thing. And this is the sort of flip side of this that people don't think about so much, but it's equally problematic. I could have a very bad hand. I could play it poorly and still win. And you have to really sort of settle yourself into both of those. So people tend to think about, I had such a great position. I had the best hand. I made great decisions. I'm so unlucky. Mm-hmm. People think about that sort of side of the equation a lot, but they don't think a lot about, oh, I played so badly. I had such a bad hand and I still won. And they don't think about that as big a disaster, but it actually is.
Because then it will condition the way you look at the next game.
Exactly. That's exactly right. So, what's interesting there is that we know that in poker, whether you win or lose the hand is a very poor signal for whether you've made good decisions. And it's actually more like what we were saying in terms of the difference between, say, American, Major League Baseball, where you play hundreds of games in a season, and football, American football, where you play 16 games in a season. One hand is not enough to tell you anything. Like, you have to play thousands and thousands and thousands of hands before we would really know what the skill differential is between us. Now, once we get in those hands, that skill differential will realize, but we've got to get a lot of hands in before we can get there. One hand doesn't tell you anything. So what that means is that this sort of resulting shortcut, this heuristic we use in order to try to reveal decision quality, because we can't, it's hard to see what, the quality of somebody else's decision is. This heuristic we use, which is, let's take the quality of the outcome and we'll work backwards to the quality of results. That only works if you're doing something where those two things are really tightly connected, where there isn't a lot of uncertainty. But in anything where there's a lot of uncertainty, like poker, or frankly, most of the decisions that you make in life, working backwards from the results is really bad. And it's because of two forms of uncertainty. We've talked a lot about the luck element, but there's also hidden information, right? I can't see the player's cards.
Mm.
So if we're like, for example, if we're in a negotiation against, where we're negotiating against each other, there's usually information asymmetry. There's going to be things that I know that you don't know. And likewise, there's going to be things that you know that I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Our next clip is from episode 85, my conversation with Hollywood actor Matthew Del Negro.
It's largely a mind game, because it's like, what's the story that you're telling yourself about how it's going? And it's hard to tell the story that, like, it's going great, this is what I'm supposed to be doing, when there are no external factors that are backing up your, your large opinion of, like, how great it's going. So there were moments, there were really, dark and scary moments. And then there were also moments where, it was a long time into it. But one of the things that I got, which was really kind of a lucky break, I had gone in for something that I found through backstage that was originally a non-union feature film. I went in, I hit it off with the filmmakers. They were from Boston. It was called The North End. It was shooting in Boston. I ended up getting the part, and it was a lead role. And then the director had he had PA'd on Casino, and he got the script to Frank Vincent, and Frank Vincent had done Raging Bull and Goodfellas. And, for those of you that don't know the name Frank Vincent, he's the one that says, in Goodfellas, now get your fucking shine box, that guy, Billy Batts. So anyway, he came on to the movie and it became union. And then he got some friends of his to join it, and it became kind of bigger than it originally was. And it was a great experience. I got a friend of mine, the part of my roommate, because he had gone in and they weren't sure. And I was like, you should cast him because we already have a history. So we went up and had a ball. It ended up going to Montreal Film Festival, Boston Film Festival. It got, right up in Variety. And it didn't really, it wasn't a huge experience in terms of like the business, mm-hmm. but for me, it really was at the time. And we, you know, it was like in our own little microcosm, we were signing autographs at these film festivals. Right. And it was like, we just had this experience of like, oh, this is kind of nice to be treated well and, you know, not be taking someone's drink order for the weekend.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, so that helped. And like, I got commercials at a certain point, and that really helped. And that was also a little bit of money. And I just kind of, I would just take that money from the commercials and pretend it didn't exist. I'd put it away and I would bartend and make my money bartending. But those things, they all helped get to the point where you could really answer someone with a straight face and when they asked you what you did and say, I'm an actor. Because it took years to say that, Ben. It was like, you know, people would say, what do you do? Well, I'm waiting tables and I'm trying to be an actor. And then it would be like, what are you doing? Well, I'm an aspiring actor, but I'm bartending at such and such. And then it would be like, well, I do this, I act, but I also, you know, and then finally it was like years into it. It's like, I'm an actor. That's what mm-hmm. I do. That's it, you know? But that was a big break. And then the bigger break that really helped was The Sopranos.
Hmm.
That was, you know, that put me from being kind of really anonymous to all of a sudden I had a chunk of work to do on the fourth season of Sopranos. I played cousin Brian Camerata, I was Edie Falco's cousin, you know, Carmela's cousin, and Tony took me under his wing. I was his financial advisor. And that was just a huge show. I mean, I still think considered one of the greatest shows in TV history.
Yeah.
And yeah, man. I mean, that was definitely a game changer to work mm. with, you know, people that talented, to work on a show that everybody was watching. All of a sudden you're riding the subway and people are saying things. It was, you know, surreal.
But you couldn't have known at that time how big the show was going to be, could you?
Well, yes, it was already. I didn't come on until the fourth season, so it was huge. So when I went in for it, it was a big deal. When the closer I got, and when they told me I was their front runner, and I had to go back in for a final like fourth or fifth callback, I had already been in for the producers. I had to go back in, and they wanted David Chase in the room, and they wanted to see a couple of other guys. Then I thought like, you know, I got so close that I thought, oh, come on, you know, I'm going to get this close and they're going to bring in some big gun to do it. Like, is this really going to happen? I'm going to be on The Sopranos, you know, because at the time you just could, you know, you'd visualize it, but you really, it was so hard. And to think of a show that big, it seemed impossible, you know?
Yeah, there's a lot of great lessons in everything that you talked about. I think we could go deep on quite a few things there, but I really like the what you were talking about in terms of, you know, it took you years, right? And so I guess what I wanted to talk a little bit about is just going back to that whole mindset and this concept of perseverance in the face of long odds, and, you know, looking back to your show, 10,000 no's. And I think sometimes we quit too early when we want something. And if you go back and think about the progress, you know, if you just set the bar at, by the age of 30, I want to be a big star or you know, whatever it was, you might have missed the incremental steps that you were making. Maybe it meant getting better as an actor, getting closer to big parts, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, interesting you bring that up, because about 9 months before that Sopranos experience, mm-hmm. I had gone in for a soap opera, and a soap opera was not my dream job, but I was bartending, and the thought of getting paid and having a contract, you know, making money, I was like, great, this will be a great training ground, you know. And so I went in, I got called back. I got called back again. It was like, it seemed like, I don't know if this is correct, but it felt like maybe seven auditions, like seven rounds of it before I was on their set in Brooklyn for a screen test, and it was me and two other guys. And it was, you know, it's high pressure. You want the job at that point. You've been thinking about it for a few weeks now, and the closer it gets, the more obsessed you get. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I kept myself together, and I felt really good about what I did there. And I left there, and I called my agent, and I said, it went really well. I think I'm going to get this thing. I'm going to get this thing. And, you know, and usually it's, you know, it's tough to say that, but I was like, I think I'm going to get it. So I wait a day, I wait another day, and he calls me. It's like, it's not going further.
Hmm.
And it's just, it's so defeating, because you're just completely back out on the street with nothing to show for that whole, you know, all of those rounds of callbacks and a screen test. It's like, oh, good for you. But it doesn't, it's like, there's no consolation prize. You just have to go audition again. And there really was a feeling at that point, like, it was such a kick in the gut. It's like, man, I'm just back to square one. But you kind of pick yourself up, you get back in the game, you study, you get inspired, and you keep going. And it's like, had I just folded after that experience with the soap opera, I would never have been in the position 9 months later to get the Sopranos. And I look at it, when I got the Sopranos, I thought, thank God I got the Sopranos, because that was such a prestigious job and such an incredibly talented group of people to work around, that it just put me in a different light. And I never, ever could have seen that on the day that my agent called to tell me I wasn't getting soap opera. You know, it just you couldn't see it from that vantage point. How could you know? So wherever people are right now, you think, you don't know what's around the corner. It might be tomorrow. It might be 6 months. It might be a year. And I think the job is just keep yourself above water, and keep getting better, and keep being inspired, and give yourself opportunities. And, you know, then you can eventually strike, because eventually, hopefully, what you're selling and what they're buying matches up and you get something.
Up next, we have a clip from my conversation with ultra endurance athlete and finance professional Chris Solars.
I think my approach to my training is the same as my approach to decision making and work, which is really the same as my, I don't know, my outlook on life, which is preparation. And doing everything you can to get ready for the big day is probably the most important. There's a Navy SEAL motto that says, the more you sweat in peacetime, the less you bleed in wartime. I love that. I've kind of adopted that as my personal motto. The Kenyans have a similar strategy, train hard, win easy. And, you know, there's another phrase that comes up a lot, like, prepare for the worst and hope for the best. And I actually think this is exactly wrong. I mean, there's no hope. You know, hoping is futile. Like, it's the antithesis of preparation. Like, you should spend all your time hoping, planning a little bit better, right? Using all that time to completely plan, and that preparation gives you the confidence on the big day. So these are some of the things I try to do, is meticulously plan out all of the worst case scenarios. And in the race, you know, you can think, it's easy to think through everything in a race, because this is a finite, controlled environment. So you plan out what you're going to eat, you plan out what you're going to wear, what you're going to drink, what happens if you get really tired. You can always pull the plug, you can always quit. You know, there's no shame in that if you decide to do that. And then, having done it 300 times in the marathon, it becomes routine. And I think that's my edge, is practicing so well that everything becomes routine. So those are some of the decision-making techniques that I've used.
I think those are very powerful. And even if things don't translate from one scenario to the next, I think just going through that process of thinking through, but also maybe subjecting yourself to those difficult moments, and just saying, hey, you know, I've been through a lot worse than what might be happening now. What about suffering in the Decaman, for example, you know, day 7, day 8, day 9, how do you think, I mean, have you thought through some of those?
Yeah, so this is half of the training, I think,
is
preparing myself for November 8th through 17th and realizing that is my time to suffer, maybe for lack of a better word. But it will be a lot of fun. The truth is it will be a grand adventure. But I know there's going to be some dark moments, but that's the time to step it up. So a lot of my training, I've been trying to get in 20 hours a week. Since August, I've been successful with that. And a lot of the time is thinking about how I'm going to feel at certain points in the race and knowing that it's going to be tough. One thing about the ultra triathlons that perhaps makes it a little bit easier than a prolonged nonstop running race or biking race is that the format lends itself to thinking in small increments. So you only have to do the swim. You have to get through the bike.
Right.
The bike is always less than 100 miles to go. And then 26 miles is always very doable. So if you only let yourself think about the next, you know, what's in front of your face, you don't have to think about the rest of the week. I think that's the most daunting thing. If you think too big on day 2, 3, 4 about how bad you feel here and extrapolate or think about the next day, you really are just taking one step at a time.
Yeah. Breaking things down into smaller chunks is just a huge, a hugely valuable technique.
That's right.
In anything.
That's right.
Yeah.
There's a running quote that I love. I could never run 1,000 miles, but I could run a mile 1,000 times. That's it.
Yeah.
That's how we get through these races.
All right, our penultimate clip is from my conversation with Paula McGuire, in which she talks about dealing with social anxiety, facing fears, and the origins of her site and her project, Paula Must Try Harder.
Forever, I treated social anxiety as something that was happening to me, something that I was suffering, something that I would go to everyone else for support for. And I always say that is the best first step, you know. Talk about it, get all the support you can. It is not in any way a sign of weakness asking for help. You know, you would never, any other condition in the world, you would not shy away from going to the doctor about or speaking to someone about, and yet we shy away from talking about mental health problems. But at a certain point, it became really clear that there was nothing else that anyone else could do for me. So it was around about my 30th birthday, and I was still seeing the doctor regularly, and psychiatry and everyone had started to say, well, maybe this is kind of as good as it gets for you. Maybe this is where we are, and this is just where it's going to stay. So taken all the medication that could possibly be given, you know, I'd pretty much tried everything, and it helped and it stabilised things, but I was not progressing. There was no way I was breaking out of it in that way, and that had become really clear. And when someone says to you, maybe this is your life now, and you can barely go outside, and you have started cutting out friends, and you know, you struggle to ground around the corner to see your parents, and you know, that to me was a real hitting home of where I had got to at the point that I had just, you know, I'd cut out absolutely everything that I possibly could that caused me anxiety, and that was pretty much everything at that point. And you know that way when you're little, you always think there's, you know, I'm going to do things with my life. You know, I'm going to help people. I'm going to change the world. And I'd never really stopped thinking that would happen. But then here I was at this point that I couldn't even change myself. You know, I couldn't even help the one person that I had, which was me. So it was kind of a combination of lots of different things happening around that time that I thought, someone is going to make a really big decision about my future. That might be the doctor saying, okay, hospital's the next step, or, you know, that was kind of the path that I was on. So I decided that if someone was going to make the decision, then I was going to make it. And I was going to try and make a really positive decision. I was going to give myself, you know, one chance to trust myself, you know, to start to take, I'd taken absolutely every opinion that I possibly could on anxiety. You know, I Googled the hell out of it and any crackpot theory that anyone had, you know, miles away on the internet, I would have said, I'll try that because their opinion matters to me. I'd never really given my own opinion any weight, and I'd never really given myself the trust to say, you know what, let's try and do this for yourself. Let's put a little bit of faith in yourself and see if you can get out of this. And that's the point that it started to turn around when I started to realise that maybe I had a little bit of power over this, or maybe not yet, but maybe I could gain a little bit of power over it, a bit of control over it, and start living healthily with anxiety. You know, you don't walk away from anxiety. That's not something that I don't ever expect that I won't have, you know, those just tendencies towards anxiety. I don't think that'll ever go. But what I wanted to try and do was to start to take back some of my own life from it, because anxiety had become everything. The only thing that I knew about myself at that point in my life was that I was anxious. So it had taken, you know, I'd let it take my entire personality. Because if you'd said to me, you know, even maybe 6 years ago, what is Paula like? I would have told you anxious, scared, nervous, timid, like that's it. I didn't know if I was kind. I didn't know if I was smart. I didn't know what I liked. You know, I didn't know, do I like films? Do I like music? I don't know. All I know is what scares me and what doesn't scare me. And when you get to that point, there's only two roads, really, and one is leading to a really bad place, and that was the road that I was on. And I decided I was jumping ship. I was climbing onto that other
road. Was there a particular moment that you remember during which you made this decision, or was it a series of steps? Was there a moment that you particularly recall, or something maybe you've read or something you saw that helped you along the way?
Yeah. I would love to say that there was a big eureka moment when I maybe just woke up and thought, this has to change now. But it was maybe over about a year of things just gradually, you know, just light bulb moments in my brain. One of them was my 30th birthday, when I really struggled to go outside. And, you know, by the age of 30, I thought, I would have it sorted, you know. I'd be a real person by the age of 30. I'd know what I was doing. I'd be strong. I'd be, you know, I would be doing something. And when that, you know, that age turned and I wasn't doing anything, I really struggled with that. And that was one thing that really cut through the anxiety and just reminded me that I should be trying harder. Then, you know, there were lots of things happening that year. Then the Olympics came, and that sounds ridiculous that, you know, that the Olympics changed my mind about something. But there was lots of talk about, you know, sport and the legacy of sport and sport being for everyone. And I remember saying to my husband, you know, oh, they've never met me. You know, they don't know me. Obviously, sport isn't for me. There's nothing outside for me. And then I started to think, well, maybe there is. You know, maybe this is something that I should try. Maybe this is something that I should try to invite into my life. So there was loads of just little moments that came together and became, you know, Paula Must Try Harder, which is where the turning point came.
And finally, we are going to finish off with a clip from my conversation with Adam Connors about the importance of networking.
All right. Well, I mean, it's something that I could be talking about for hours, so I'll try to kind of to be as precise as possible.
Sure.
I define networking as a proactive approach to relationship development. Mm-hmm. It's connecting people and creating a community with the aim of all parties mutually benefiting. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not what happens at networking events. It's more of a skill that's practiced and honed throughout years. Mm-hmm. You know, it's building relationships. It's finding a common interest. It's helping. It's giving. It's sharing ideas, it's sharing leads, it's sharing information. I guess the best way to think about what is a network, it's a powerful system that offers three unique advantages. It gives the advantage to private information.
Mm-hmm.
It gives you access to a diverse skill set and ideas. And what a network also really does, it provides, it gives you power and influence.
Mm-hmm.
I could just keep going and going. I don't know if you want me to.
No, keep going. This is good. This is good stuff. Yeah. This is your domain. So absolutely.
Yeah. So, I mean, think about the power of a network. Think about what can be done, if you've surrounded yourself with great people. Mm-hmm. I honestly could just keep going on and on and on. The higher the quality of your network, the greater magnitude of your success. Mm. It's just true. I'm sure everyone here knows who Tony Robbins is. Mm-hmm. Tony Robbins, his idol was a guy by the name of Jim Rohn.
Mm.
And Jim Rohn, I'm probably going to botch this quote, but you'll get the genesis of it. He said essentially that you are the aggregate of the five people you spend the most time with.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just, money, it's your health, your well-being, how you think of things. And that's your nucleus. That's your nucleus network.
Mm.
But there's all different kinds of networks too. And a lot of people, I have this thing, this template that I've built, it's called a sphere of influence.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've come to notice is that people, and you pointed this out right away, when you talked about LinkedIn, people think about their networks. I would always ask people, hey, how many people are in your network?
Mm-hmm.
And you've got one school of thought that says, oh my God, I've got probably about 650, 700 people in my network. And then you got the other school that they don't think that they've got, and I really don't have any.
Mm.
And that's actually not true. That there's a happy medium there somewhere. And what I do is I help people to really break down to first and foremost understand what is networking, which is so important.
Mm-hmm.
And then what are you working with? If you start thinking about the network, you start thinking about the people that are kind of in your sphere of influence. First think about, there's obviously families to give in, and I try to not focus on that because, mm-hmm. There's maybe sports that you've played or hobbies that you've had. Think about there's things that are called fringe friends, and mm-hmm. fringe friends are actually the most important elements of all networking because it's your friends' friends is essentially what the fringe friends are, or that one person removed.
Mm-hmm.
That's the hidden job market right there.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the people with the ideas that are going to come up with ideas that you're not necessarily familiar with because you're not in that echo chamber that we talked about earlier. It's getting outside of your regular sphere.
Mm.
That's part of your network. So there's alumni groups that are your networks. There's mm-hmm. if you're involved in any kind of religious affiliation, that's a network.
Mm-hmm.
Think about people that speaking of alumni, work alumni, people that you work with in work. Think about vendors that might be servicing you. There's all these. If you start really breaking them down, and then the average person, according to Dunbar's laws, essentially, you've got roughly 150 people is kind mm-hmm. of really mm-hmm. what your network is. So, yeah, that's high level networking.
Right, right. And we often don't think about all of those things. And but when you think about the opportunities that come up, so for example, this conversation, it started with a conversation between Tom and I, and that now we're connected. But I didn't really know that Tom knew you, right? So this, I think there's that level of those nodes that permeate from the different people that we know. Who knows what's behind there, and that somebody in that network knows something or someone or can provide some help, and vice versa.
You're hitting the nail on the head. I had a guy on my show a couple weeks ago by the name of Bob Wu. Mm-hmm. Bob Wu is a good friend of mine, great guy, a deep thinker. And mm-hmm. I love – he summed it up, and again, I'm not good with quotes, but it's something to the effect of every time that I meet somebody, in my head, I'm thinking that this is not the only time I'm ever going to see them. And it doesn't matter if they are serving him food in a cafeteria or if the CEO of a company. So he goes in thinking about, you know, again, how can I help somebody? And you know, what's the most value that I could provide for this person? Because they're going to boomerang back in my life at some point.
Mm-hmm. All right, folks, I think that's a great place to end it because it's a wonderful message. Lead with giving. And as a result, perhaps grow your support network and maybe expose yourself to some positive surprises, but just lead with giving. Great way to enter 2019. All right, that does it for our third annual Best of the All Things Risk podcast. And once again, when I say best of, that's really with air quotes because I had to leave so many wonderful clips from some great episodes out. If you think I missed anything, just drop me a note, allthingsrisk@gmail.com. If anything piqued your interest, go back and check out the full episode. Check out all the episodes. We've got 98 episodes apart from this one, and we will be back with another one in 2 weeks' time. In the interim, and as always, don't forget, risk is life.